space postage. All right, make sure you're in fellowship as we continue on here. Getting back into the text here in verse 13 and 14, we read the two verses. And who is there to harm you to prove zealous for what is good? But even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. And do not fear their intimidation, and do not be troubled. Here in verse 13, whereas Peter omitted the question, the original question as presented in the Psalm passage, verses 10 through 12, he now provides his own question for all intents and purposes of why he has referred to these passages, as well as to address the central theme regarding this particular book, and that is the undeserved suffering that these early Christians and Asian churches were facing at this point in time. Now, the question itself, and who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good, is rhetorical. How do we know it's rhetorical, which we expect no one, rather than just a straightforward question? And that is because it's based on an absolute premise. That absolute premise, as I've been bringing out to you, is stated in verse 12, where the eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer, but the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. The absolute premise of which the rhetorical nature of the question is based upon is the fact that God is always for that which is good, that which is right, and against evil. And we know it's an absolute because God is absolute righteousness. If he is less than anything absolute righteous in this regard, in him there is no darkness, he is absolute light, then he would be less than God. So the absolute aspect of the question in itself stands upon the integrity of God, not on man. See. And maybe that helps clear up the air as I go on through this to try to bring this over. And this is how he starts his polemics or his threads of reasoning in regards to this particular section that we're getting into, and that is that indeed the premise of the rhetorical nature of the question is based on an absolute truth, one that will not change, one you can expect to be forever as it always has been with God, as being absolutely righteous, always embracing that which is good, and always opposed to evil in this respect. Now, volition, obviously, too, is a part of his argument here, and that brought out in a third class condition, as we saw, if you prove zealous for what is good. And the proving zealous looks at re-explains one who in for what is good, re-explains back in verse 11, the one who does good and seeks peace and pursues it. The one who intentionally seeks peace and pursues it, that's a zealot. That's one who is positive in this respect. So positive volition is instrumental in regards to understanding the absolute nature in regards to Peter's rhetorical question here in this respect. And to become a zealot then of a good thing, literally, in that respect, demands that the individual believer is positive and both inhale and exhale faith application of Bible doctrine in this respect. And the subjunctive verb to prove or give evidence to become, if you will, literally, indicates potential and further points in self-discipline positive volition exercises in applying Bible doctrine. Again, positive volition is not just some dormant state of will. It is a will that is willfully and actively producing energy of doing things in life, and this obviously in regards to, as we say, positive volition in one's attitude with respect to the truth of Bible doctrine, in both inhale, the assimilation of the truth, as well as exhale faith. And that's where we left off there, page 42.37 in our notes. Application of righteousness is the evidence of proof of positive volition. So self-discipline, to be positive, demands one's self-discipline. Establish your priorities and apply Bible doctrine appropriately, and then you give evidence of truly being positive. And James made that clear in his epistle in regards to that emphasizes application of doctrine as phase two righteousness, as evidence of phase two righteousness. James 2:23, if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, can't just come to Bible class and listen to it and not apply it in your life. It's worthless. essentially, in that sense, for you. It's like no benefit to you if you're not going to apply. See? It's like someone that says, here's $1 million in the bank, and you never go to the bank and pull it out to use it. What good is it? How does it benefit you? Especially when you're in need of it. See? And we're all in need of doctors. If anyone is to hear the word and not do it, verse 23, is like a man who looks at his natural face in a mirror. The one who has looked at himself and gone away has immediately forgotten what kind of person he was. And verse 22 is just as appropriate. But prove yourself doers of the word, not merely hearers who delude themselves. That's the application to doctrine, 3:18. And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace. The peace that is being emphasized by Peter, by those who make peace. They sow it and make it. They produce it. And that demands application in the realm of peace. And then 4:17, therefore, the one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, then it is a sin. Failure to apply Bible doctrine is missing the mark because righteousness is under his directed will. And hence it's a sin. Alright, 38, moving on here. That Peter's question here then is presented as an absolute with respect to the promise given by the just of believers. Those are two things that establish regards to the question. It's an absolute, it's based on an absolute, and it's a promise given to quality believers. The reader then must then determine in what way is it an absolute, that it will be applied absolutely for us. So 39, obviously, he is not trying to delude his readers with the idea that if their conduct is in line with Bible doctrine, they will escape abuse, maltreatment, physical injury, or the like. To go off in knee-jerk reaction and state that, and that's what he's stating in this regard, is obviously a total denial of context. He's already dealt with the fact that they're under attack. Slander is coming their way, oppression, and verbal abuse is all around them in this respect. So, obviously, try to convince, a believer that, get in line with Bible doctrine, nothing bad ever happened to you, that's ludicrous. That's not where he's coming from. 40, the answer here is found by inserting the key of positive volition, as ultimately determining the absolute nature and truism of the hypothesis, who is there to harm you? The result. Who is there to harm you? And the key centers on the aspect of volition. So 41, Peter's use of the term harm here is to recognize the intended result of mistreatment and the like as a way to oppress, coerce, or subjugate their victims. As we saw in the use of this term earlier in the actions of the Egyptians subjugating the Jews in slavery. The mistreatment is to keep them down in subjugation, to oppress them. See, as the institution of slavery, in a way that slaves are often dealt with, to treat them harshly, to keep them subjugated. Oppressed in this regard. You recognize them in abusive marital relationships. The husband constantly physically beating the wife, keep her down and subjugated and oppressed. Keeping her at fear and at bay. See. So, his use of the term harm here looks to the intended result of why people mistreat or abuse. Also, the Herod in regards to church. It's just a to oppress them, to subjugate them, to keep them from expressing themselves and doing what they're doing. So that's 42, the ultimate intent of evil antagonists, those who are negative, who take issue and attack you in regards to your stand for doctrine. The ultimate intent of evil antagonists is to repress the expression of positive volition applied by the saints. Stand for doctrine, people taking pot shots at you, is intended to get you to back off, to stop what you're doing, to attack you in that regard, to quit believing that way, quit making the application in this direction. See, and I understand that's what the tacks are designed to do ultimately. At least take it off and don't do it around me or whatever. See. So you got to understand the purpose of why attacks occur. It's just like in a war. You attack a nation to oppress it and subjugate it and to put it under your control. See. So the ultimate intent of evil antagonists is to repress the expression of positive volition applied by the saints. 43, Peter's argument here is that, quote, absolutely not, end quote, can negative volition overturn, thwart, or impede the vital interests associated with their positive volition. 44, this summarily and principally, obviously, includes a positive volition salvation adjustment and their eternal salvation. All that accompanies that, positional truth, etc. No matter what people do to you, you hear the gospel, they cannot control your soul. They can't control your thoughts. They try. But they can't control your will in regards to what you want to believe in this respect. And it all begins, obviously, with the salvation adjustment. Romans 8:35-39 brings about the significance of the security of salvation in no uncertain terms in that respect. For I am convinced, Paul states, that neither death nor life nor angels nor principalities nor things present nor things to come nor powers nor height nor death nor any other created things shall be able to separate us from the love of God, which is, quote, or emphasis in Christ Jesus our Lord. So their antagonism can't stop you from being saved, and neither can it do anything to impede the eternal security that's attached to your salvation. B, obviously it includes positive volition to rebound, overruling the FCA. They may take pot shots at you, slander you, whatever, but it doesn't stop you from rebounding and staying in fellowship yourself. They can't impede that. They can't cause you not to rebound. 1 John 1:9. Anytime you do that, that rebound takes, they can't inhibit that. If you confess, he's faithful and just to forgive. See. So see, obviously includes positive volition completing their course and then the maturity adjustment. 1 Corinthians 9:24. All believers are in a race. All believers run. We're all put in a race upon our salvation adjustment. And we are commanded to run to win the prize, see, to be a winner in this respect. And obviously, if the imperative is there, the means will be provided otherwise for one to complete their course. If God can't expect you to be in a race and run without providing the provisions, you know, for you to accomplish His will for you in that matter. In Revelation 2:10, in regards to the church, the message of Smyrna, do not fear what you're about to suffer. Behold, the devil's about to cast some of you into prison, and you may be tested, and you have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life, the wreath of life. Hence, and no matter what goes on around them, they will be given total and complete opportunity to run and complete their course and become prize contenders. And God will not impede that. Now, it may be that, you know, at the end of somebody's life, like Paul, that they end up in prison. But they got the doctrine that has sufficient doctrine throughout their lives to carry them through that period of testing, see, etc. And then, B, on top of it all attendant increments of their SG3 account is beyond their reach, beyond anything that they can do in regards to interfering with your eternal rewards. Matthew 6:19-20.
Do not lay up for yourselves treasure upon earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasure in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys, where thieves do not break in or steal. Nobody can touch your SG3. For every aspect of getting in fellowship and applying doctrine, every second of redeeming the time, and your reward account is being adjusted with the SG3, it's there. It's in heaven. It's out of reach. And then obviously, 1 Peter, as we saw, 1 Peter 4:6, in regards to the very nature of SG3, in regards to our inheritance, to obtain an inheritance which is imperishable and undefiled, will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. You are protected by the power of God through faith for salvation, for deliverance, ready to be revealed the last time, through the resurrection. In this you greatly rejoice, or SG3, is there, and nobody can impede you from earning it and attaining it, and literally enjoying it in resurrection body, even though now for a little while of necessary you have been distressed by various tests. So 45, bottom line here, maybe religion cannot effectively do anything. But said God's plan for positive volition inhibits their faith. Not effectively. They may try to throw their monkey wrenches in it, all these other things. But they cannot effectively stop your positive volition and fulfilling God's plan for your life. We'll see Jesus once again will be brought out an example in this respect. An ultimate vindication. Look at the Jews and their agenda for Jesus. And their scheming, the killing. Taking him across and killing, getting out of this world. Well, apparently on the surface, it looks like they accomplished what they did. But that is not the reality of what happened. The reality of what happened is God simply used their naked volition to put Jesus in circumstances, situations to go to the cross to bear sins for mankind and provide our freedom. And that respect for all eternity and our so great salvation. But they didn't even effectively kill him. He checked his humanity out with his own deity. So what did they do to him? They didn't do anything, really. And that's in regards to God's plan for Messiah. Neither can anyone do anything to us in regards to our expression of positive volition fulfilling God's plan for our life. Because this is based on God, his norms and standards, his power, and all these things, his essence and his attributes. 46. Peter's argument here follows the very premise of absolute established in Matthew 10:28. And do not fear those who kill the body, but are unable to kill the soul. Or rather fear him who is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Says another absolute, established. The worst man can do to you is overtly, physically. But they can't touch your soul. They can't touch your will. Your soul, the real you, is where your volition resides. Only God has that power. See? And he also has, since he has power over the real you, he has power over the physical. So, that premise is another absolute. That man can do nothing to your soul. You can't touch it. Your soul is yours. It's your personal possession. Its ultimate destiny is based completely and totally on our persons, nobody else. No matter what else somebody might try to do in regards to interrupting our life and expression of desiring to know God, etc., etc., to fulfill his plan for our life. And like I, you know, have stated in the past, that we have special protection being positive, and we have the encouragement that nothing can impede our positive volition. Now we've got the verses, and Peter's bringing out the argument in an absolute concrete way to state the same thing. So like I said, we state these things quite often, but to run across actual verses, and you have to really tear into it to see the depth of the argument that he's providing in his concrete foundation of which it's built on, it's really appreciated. So Peter's argument follows the very premise established in Matthew 10:28. Man can't do anything to the soul. Only God has that right and privilege and power. So 47, Hebrews 11 is full of positive faith and evidence that even the most vile and aggressive of negative volition could not impede their ultimate fulfillment of God's plan. Just as an example there, in Hebrews 11, which we often refer to as the Hall of Famers, spiritually, in regards to Moses and the Pharaoh Moses, Abedin, that male children, born male children, be killed by the Jews, and did that impede Moses in regards to his life, and God foreknew that he was going to be positive, he had a plan for him. Even as a child, it was totally completely out of his hands, and his parents, they faith rested. And God made provision and delivered by faith. Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were afraid of the king's edict, the decree. By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to call the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than enjoy the absent pleasures of sin. Considering the reproach of Christ, greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, where he is looking to the reward. By faith he left Egypt, not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. All that Moses went through, and even the civil, governmental stumbling blocks that was placed before his life, was right through it. God read his holy volition. God had a plan for his life, and God and Moses was going to fulfill it. And God knew that, and he made provision all the way for Moses in that respect, in spite of even the most powerful empire that exists on that planet, what they attempted to do to stop it. Could not impede God's plan for Moses. See, that's the principle there, the point I'm bringing out. 48, this is inclusive of all the post-history evils, a negative religion, posture to upset the plan of God after the fact. Even as Old Testament saints await the completion of the church age for their full rewards. Appreciate this point in regards to Old Testament saints who did die for the faith, and they were faithful in that regards. They obviously have SG3 coming, but they will not get their rewards until their resurrection and the second advent. Well, about all the time in history in between their death and waiting on their rewards, etc. And obviously, we know nothing is going to keep them from ultimately attaining these rewards. Hebrews 11, 35 through 40, especially verses 35 to 39a. Women received that their dead by resurrection, and others were tortured, not accepting the release in order that they might attain a better resurrection. That's what they're looking for. The promise in fulfillment of God's plan for their life and things of this nature. And others experiencing mockings and scourgings, yes, also chains and imprisonments, all the suffering that much of positive religion has been through over history. They were stoned, they were sawn in tune, they were tempted, they were put in to death, martyred. By murder of the sword, they went about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, ill-treated, men of whom the world was not worthy, wandering in deserts, mountains, and caves, and holes in the ground. This is all a reflection upon positive volition. People who were committed to the plan of God, willing to endure whatever suffering they had to endure, whether by the hand of people or otherwise, see, economically, etc. All of these, having gained approval through their faith, this statement that they are great winners, candidates in this regard, and all the SG3, did not receive what was promised. Not at that point in time, ultimate vindication. Ultimate sanctification has not yet occurred for them. Because God had provided something better for us, so that apart from us, they should not be made perfect. So obviously, they must wait for the church age dispensation, remaining 7 years of Israel, to be completed before they receive the rewards. But nothing's going to impede that. All the evil in history that goes in between their time of dying and waiting on the rewards, trying to upset God's plan, upset all this and the promises, etc., that's going to stop God. And that's going to stop all this, his promises being fulfilled in this respect. See. All right. 49, establishing the absolute for the premise of Peter's apologetic here, is then ready to seal up with an inevitable conclusion of logic in verse 14. So he establishes the absolute, and then he brings that to a logical conclusion, which is a sure thing. So 50, Peter's task for encouraging these saints is to first present the best case scenario in verse 13, and now follows with the worst case they could expect otherwise. Best case scenario, the picture you like to see, is who's there to harm you if you're positive? And you're a flying Bible doctor. Worst case scenario is you will suffer. See? That's your worst case. So he gives you kind of your best case and worst case scenario for contrast. So Peter's tact, 49 again, establishing the absolute for the premise of Peter's apologetic, he is then ready to seal it with an added, inevitable conclusion of logic in verse 14. If Peter's task for encouraging these saints is to first present the best case scenario in verse 13, and now follows with the worst case they could expect otherwise. 51, this is the emphasis of the contrasting clause, but, in stark contrast, Allah, even if you should suffer for the sake of righteousness, you are blessed. So 52, Peter takes the next step in logic from his question, the rhetorical question, to now point out that if positive volition is immune to the attacks of negative volition as to their vital interests, then obviously the believer's interaction with these types are designed to produce favorable results. Whatever interaction you may have in regards to those who are antagonists is designed to bring blessing to you, something good. 53, even in a worst-case scenario of suffering, undeserved suffering, even in a worst-case scenario for positive volition under undeserved suffering, it is a win-win situation. Now, how often do people look at their suffering in life in that light? Oh, this is a win-win situation for me, because I'm in fellowship, it's undeserved, I'm like an SG3, and nothing can stop my positive volition. See? So, Peter, like I said earlier, first hour, you'd hardly know that he was raised a fisherman, a common person in this regard, with regards to the depth of understanding and his ability to assimilate a good doctrine together in his own thinking and then express it. Obviously, he's under fellowship and under the ministry of God the Holy Spirit, but so can any one of us be at any given point in time a doctrine. And this doesn't come just from showing up at Bible class, once a month or whatever. It comes from a commitment in time and grade of putting these things together. So even in a worst-case scenario, for population under undeserved suffering, it is a win-win situation. 54. Peter takes an absolute of Bible doctrine, which was presented in verses 10 through 12, and then uses ironclad logic to present two further absolutes, of verse 13 and 14, to build the confidence of these saints. The logic is designed to build confidence, to fight sin fear when we're in the midst of negative attacks against us. 55, he is providing a sparkling example of what he will next refer to as, quote, always being ready to make a defense, end quote, with respect to Bible doctrine in verse 15. He's given us a perfect example of how to defend Bible doctrine. And he takes an absolute that he knows about God, his plus R, and the fact that in that absolute state, always, he embraces good, he opposes evil. Now he builds his argument. Let's see. 56. Now Peter presents his second apologetic here in the form of a beatitude, also known as an aphorism, taken from this term Makarios. So he presents it here in the form of a beatitude that can be rendered, what is more, even if you should suffer, in parentheses. you are blessed. What is more, you are blessed. Even if he shows up. So it's a beatitude, in the form of a beatitude. 57, of the safety from harms, in verse 13, parallels the blessedness of verse 14. And therefore, by no means rules out the possibility of, quote, suffering for the sake of righteousness, end quote. So, no harm with blessing obviously indicates that you can otherwise expect suffering, and obviously in the form of righteousness, for the sake of righteousness, standing for God's plan. 58, the premise of the Beatitude is probably an adaptation of Matthew 5:10. Leading off teaches, teaching of Christ himself. In the Sermon on the Mount, verse 10, blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So it's at the very least an adaption of an indirect reference, if not direct. So 59, now Peter presents the Beatitude using a rare form of Koine Greek in the New Testament. Koine simply means the common Greek of the time, common man's Greek. Employing here a fourth-class condition, if you should suffer, I posco, conditional particle, with your present active paucity. And again, this mood is used only 76 times in the New Testament. If you should suffer. So 60, the fourth-class condition is of the future with a remote possibility, if perhaps in the future, though improbable, or same chance or whatever. 61, now the apostle is the result, then follows, you are blessed. Whereas, verse 13, he provided the hypothesis first, the result, who can harm you. And then the hypothesis, if you prove zealous here, he puts it in its normal sequence. With the hypothesis following the hypothesis. So 62, as we brought out in our parsing, it is suggested by Wallace in the Greek grammar Beyond the Basics. By the way, for any Greek student, that's a good book. It is a very good book for the language. That Peter is here implying that these saints have yet to undergo any real persecution for the faith in their lives. So he's suggesting that possibly this is what the fourth class condition is emphasizing in this respect. So 63, in other words, the persecution for them is only a threat with a remote possibility of exploding into reality. 64, yet this is in direct contradiction with other statements made by Peter that persecution and oppression was real for these churches in Asia Minor. They began in chapter 1, verse 6, denoting that they've been distressed. Well, if you're distressed, you're being oppressed. And persecution exists. Suffering, true suffering, exists for them in this regard. And in 2:12, regards to the slander and the attempts of people to try to bring government down on their head and things of this nature, and how to deal with that in regards to the verbal attacks. And then 15, for such is the will of God that by doing right may silence the ignorance of foolish men. 18, servants, be submissive to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also those who are unreasonable. That tells you both cases, both the circumstances are there. And then 4, 12 through 9, in regards to blood, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing. These things are occurring. And he's telling them, don't be caught off guard. Blah, blah, blah. So that also, the revelation of glory, you may rejoice with exultation. And it's getting down to 19. Therefore, let those who also who suffer according to the will of God entrust their souls to the faithful Creator in doing what is right. In 5, 9, and 10, but resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same experience of suffering are being accomplished by your brothers who are in the world. So, the suffering's there. You can't get around that. They are experiencing it. Now, you know, to a degree, obviously there's going to be a time in history where the church corporately, in this particular point of the world, is going to be under probably corporately more harsh suffering, but individually, they're all have their tests and the oppressions that they're facing. And as you have suffered, verse 10, for a little while the God of all grace has called you to his eternal glory in Christ will himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. So, to say the fourth class condition here is implying that they're not undergoing suffering. And it's only a remote possibility sometime in the future that they might. It doesn't make any sense. Not based on what we see otherwise in Peter. And so therefore, is there another aspect of this fourth class condition? And that's what you've got to answer. 65, again, another question arises as to what is Peter's intent of use in this context? The fourth class condition in the context. So 66, given the fact that Peter is building his discourse on absolutes, that absolutely this is the way it is, it seems most feasible that he's referring to suffering as to degree, not possibility of occurrence, even though the number of times might be part of it. That's not his emphasis. The emphasis is on the degree of suffering, no matter the number of times or the height of the suffering in and of itself might occur. That's the emphasis of the fourth class condition of this remote possibility. Verse 13, that degree is feasible in regards to his thinking, but to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ. So given the fact that Peter's building his discourse on absolutes, it seems most feasible that he's referring to suffering as to degree, not possibility of occurrence. 67, that is, if even the slightest circumstances of suffering is experienced. That's the remote nature of his hypothesis that he's trying to bring over. 68, Peter has chosen the use of the fourth class condition to relate the absolute of suffering to cover even the minutest or least of occasions. To complement the absolute nature of his initial rhetorical question. Who can harm you if you are zealous for what is good? But now he's covering the aspect of suffering in that respect. And he's saying, now, it didn't make any difference the level or the intensity or number, etc., degree of suffering that you may experience, this premise still remains true. So he's chosen a fourth class condition to relate the absolute of suffering to cover even the minutest or least of occasions. 69, this includes the shortest of times and most remote attacks. It doesn't mean that somebody just has to go in and do what they have to do to get you in prison and kill you. It doesn't have to be that degree of suffering. Any suffering in this realm. Any undeserved suffering that we experience from anybody. That's where he's coming from here. So this includes the shortest of time, the most remote of attacks. Saying no matter the degree of undeserved suffering that believers should experience for the sake of righteousness, he is blessed. 71, the causal phrase, because or for the sake of righteousness, refers to undeserved suffering from the source of people brought on by adherence to Bible doctrine. It's for the sake of God's righteousness, his directed will, application evident in one's Christian life. 72, any suffering believers experience at the hands of others as a result of just sticking to their niche and their walk of life while applying Bible doctrine and fellowship easily satisfies the cause. Just in your niche, doing your thing, going to Bible class, applying Bible doctrine, rebound, etc., etc. And, you know, during that course of time, you experience undeserved suffering at the hands of another individual antagonistic doctrine. Well, you're covered. You're doing it for the sake of righteousness. And that gives you more of a comprehensive view in regards to forming one's niche because we're not perfect, but overall. So any suffering believers experience at the hands of others as a result of just sticking to their niche and their walk of life while applying Bible doctrine and in the filling of the Holy Spirit easily satisfies the cause. So 73, to be blessed, Makarios, in the Greek, is to gain divine approbation and to qualify for phase 3 rewards, obviously SG3. 74, the Spirit-filled and justice believer can expect SG3 for every occasion that they are attacked by antagonists, apropos, obviously, to the level and intensity of the attack. God's going to obviously have a bigger or whatever aspect of SG3 for one who's martyred than someone that, you know, somebody just goes a few verbal derogatory statements at him under undeserved suffering. So it'll be apropos, obviously, to the level and intensity of the attack, time, degree, etc. 75, this might come to someone far off that is slandering you and you're not even aware of it at the moment. God sees all these things. I'm telling you, it pays to stay in fellowship. You never know. People are antagonistic towards you, slandering you because, you know, you stand for the truth of Bible doctrine to other people. Jesus, God knows all that stuff. And I'm 99.9% convinced that this is the emphasis of this fourth class edition. It covers every gamut of undeserved suffering there is in hostile attacks. The degree, always leave that 1/10 open just in case. I'm not perfect, but God is. So 76, now in contrast of degree, for sake of argument for these particular believers, these saints are part of the generation of Asian churches that can expect a very intense period of persecution, beginning with Nero in 70 A.D. Obviously, the date of Peter's epistle is right at 63-64 A.D. Another 6 years down the road, that's when Nero comes on board. And the Asian churches, as we saw in Revelation 2:10, in the church of Smyrna, in Asia Minor, very intense persecution will come upon the board. So we don't miss that. We understand that. Corporately, you have your periods and times of more intensity and less. But individually, obviously, it is still applicable across the board. 77, those that persevere to the end will truly be blessed with the reap of life, as Revelation 2:10 makes clear. 78, now Peter then ties up his thoughts with two final imperatives. And do not fear their intimidation, and do not be troubled. Let's see if we can deal with this. 79, this begins a new sentence in the Greek text, with its main idea intended to be carried forward into verses 15 and 16. New American Standard shows a new sentence in my New American Standard. And do not fear their trouble, their intimidation, not be troubled, comma. But verse 15 begins. It's all part of the same sentence. So 80, these imperatives reflect that Peter expects his presentations of absolutes, his apologetics, his defense of the faith, to have a direct effect upon the courage of the saints to stay the course. If you can be so rest assured of the absolute nature of this, that obviously ought to build up your courage. You're going to be a winner, you know. You get, and still, in your warriors, we will experience absolute victory. Here it goes. You know, this is why. This is why we got. Here's the proof. The reason why. World War II. We got the A-bomb. They don't understand. You know, whatever. Well, we're here, obviously, we're dealing with God. And He's our support in this respect. So He expects, obviously, doctrine to have a direct effect upon the courage of the saints to stay the course. That's what I pray for each and every one of us, to stay the course, come hell or high water, to put it in my vernacular from the Midwest. Hell or high water, stay the course. Stay in Bible class. Keep applying doctrine, be fastidious and rebound, and stand back and watch the mighty hand of God deliver. Ultimately, my statements will be shown to be true. 81. Now, the logic here expressed, the logic expressed here rhetorically is, if a justified volition is guaranteed a win-win situation, why is there reason to fear? See how he builds upon his logic in regards to these particular statements. 82, there is no doctrinal or other absolute reason to forsake righteousness in the face of our attackers. There is none. There is no excuse. There's no excuse that will be accepted by God, I guarantee it, famously. 83, his continued words of encouragement now, here in this final aspect of this particular verse, are from Isaiah 8, 12b to 13. Here the context is the threat of Assyria attacking northern Israel. And here in verse 11, for thus the Lord spoke to me, Isaiah the prophet, with mighty power, instructed me not to walk in the way of this people. And this people is the Jews of Israel in regards to hearing the situation in regards to Assyria attacking them, saying, you are not to say it's a conspiracy in regard to all that this people call a conspiracy in regards to, as we've seen elsewhere, false teachers saying this ain't going to happen, blah, 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 this is all conspiracy. But the true aspect in regards to the rumor of King Assyria coming in and attacking them. And so the instruction, don't get wrapped up, obviously, in their mindset. And you are not to fear what they fear. Now, this is for our intents and purposes. Or be in dread of it. What they fear is the king of Assyria. And the attack is going to come upon Israel. See. It is the Lord of hosts whom you should regard as holy, verse 13. And he shall be your fear, and he shall be your dread. So, probably already, you've already picked out, do not fear man, fear God. We're back to that one. So, his continued words are from the Isaiah passage 12b to 13. 84, the context of Isaiah 8 is that the prophet and his followers are not to share the fear of the populace. Do not fear what they fear in regards to the New American Standard. That's the Jews fearing the King of Israel. As we saw, prepare verse 11, as a threat to the invasion of Israel. So 85, the populace fear was the fear of man. 86, what was true for Isaiah is true for believers today, and that is to fear no man. 87, rather we are to fear God, as Isaiah continues in 8:13. 88, Peter here in this particular verse changes the pronoun from how to the singular his third person in the Septuagint. With reference to the King of Syria, the Septuagint of Isaiah 8:12 to outone there in our verse to correlate the idea of persecutors for the enemy. You look at the English in the New American Standard in regards to the Isaiah passage, it doesn't really repeat the exact grammar of the Hebrew, but it gives a proper intent in regards to it. And you are not to fear of him in its reflection in regards to the king of Syria, as it uses the pronoun how to, but it's also in reflection to what the people fear. So the New American Standard captures that intent. And then Peter captures the intent literally in regards to his grammar, to correlate the idea of persecutors or enemy, the enemy of the king of Syria, to the Jews or our antagonists of the believers in the church. So 89, Peter's appeal to the Isaiah text is apropos to his apologetic, as it points now directly to the absolute of Matthew 10:28. Do not fear man who can kill the body, not touch the soul. See, fear God who can wrap both of them up for eternity in hell. 90, Peter takes his premise in form. In form, in ideas. And now applies it to these believers not to fear the intimidation tactics brought about from the source of their antagonist. 91, that is, those things that would incite sin fear from the believer. 92, the final command, and do not be troubled, parasso, means to be terrified as with sudden fear, such as Matthew 14. Point 6, used in that context, when disciples saw Christ walking on the sea, they were frightened, sudden fear, saying it is the ghost, and they cried out for fear. So, 93, now these words, do not be troubled, recall John 14:1, as well as 14:27. Let not your heart be troubled. Believe in God, believe also in me. Our term. And then verse 27. Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. Not as the world gives, but do I give to you. Let not your heart be troubled, nor let it be fearful. So 94, however, they too owe their form of ideas to Isaiah 8:12c in regards to situations. We're not to fear that of God's creation. And that draws this idea from the fact that there's nothing in creation that can harm your soul. And hence, it owes this form, an idea, to the absolute of God in regards to having power over our souls, and man not, even though it emphasizes in particular circumstances or situations rather than people. 95, now the final phrase here emphasizes that part of overruling fear is to continue to embrace the peace provided by God. That was 27a, peace I leave with you. See, peace is the issue. And hence, pursue that peace, and you will neutralize sin fear. And 96, how one finds the strength to do so through faith is through faith. That's positive volition. That was the emphasis 14:1, 1b, believe in God, believe also in me. That's how your heart's not troubled. So that belief emphasizes the positive volition. So between the two references, we have the principle of peace and positive volition put together for us. 97. Sin fear induces us to compromise and thus deny Christ. 98. We must resist the urge to be afraid in the face of threats so that we can achieve the righteousness of God and the reward associated with endurance. 99, we find our basis of confidence in the absolute truth that the enemy cannot overturn our vital interests. And in spite of any attacks, we earn the approbation of God who is with us through it all. Father, again, we thank you for the truth of your word. We ask God, the Holy Spirit, to continue to light us these things in Jesus' name.